I'd like to talk for a bit about cause and effect. You know what I mean when I talk about that? So cause and effect is the idea that you have two events that are connected, and one of them produces or triggers or leads to the other. So they're directly connected. One of them causes the other to happen. That's cause and effect. If you're trying to teach that concept to kids, a great series of books that you can use is actually the If You Give a Mouse a Cookie books. Some of you parents might know about these, or if you don't, you really should. It is a whole series. So there's If You Give a Pig a Party, If You Give a Cat a Cupcake, and my personal favorite is If You Give a Moose a Muffin. Great series of books, but the premise of each book is very similar. So it starts with a kid at the beginning of the book who gives the animal in question something that then leads to something else. So in this one, you have the kid at the beginning gives the mouse a cookie. Well, you know, when he gives the mouse a cookie, then the mouse wants milk to go with the cookie. So they get milk to go with the cookie. Well, then after they finish the milk and cookie, the mouse is concerned that he now has a milk mustache. So he's got to go look at himself in the mirror. And when he looks at himself in the mirror, he realizes that he needs a haircut. And on it goes until just spoiler alert here, parents, if you want to cover your kids' ears so they don't get the end of the book. What happens at the end is we've kind of come full circle, and now, you know, we're back to the mouse wanting another cookie. So that's cause and effect. Now, there's another kind of concept that goes with cause and effect, and there's an axiom to describe this particular relationship. It's correlation does not equal causation. You ever heard that one? So the idea is that you have two events and they are connected, but you don't have one that causes the other. There's some kind of relationship between them, but it's not a cause and effect relationship. So just for example, I came across a cartoon this past week in which there's two kids, a brother and sister, and the sister's standing there holding a video game controller, and the brother is standing there as well. And I actually have it up here on the screen. You see there's a video game controller sticking out of the TV screen that's cracked, and the mom is, of course, fuming. And the brother says, well, correlation does not imply causation. He's trying to get out of trouble there. Well, we are continuing in this series where we want to burst some bubbles. And the bubbles that we're bursting are kind of some Christian myths or urban legends, some ideas that many Christians hold that are not true, or at least they need to be qualified or explained. You hopefully saw on the title slide, the myth that we want to bust this morning is a godly home guarantees godly kids. So we want to talk about the relationship between a godly home and godly children. And so this title there, the bubble that we're bursting, implies cause and effect. You know, where the cause is a godly home with committed Christian parents. And if that's what you have as the cause, then the effect must naturally be godly, committed Christian children. And yet what I want to suggest to you this morning is that there is a correlation between godly homes and godly kids, but it is not a cause and effect relationship the way the bubble implies. So we want to unpack that this morning. And as we do that, I recognize that I speak to people in different spots when it comes to this kind of a myth. So there would be some of you who are parents, who are raising kids right now, and you're kind of in the thick of it. And I hope that you come away with some encouragement and also some clarity about this particular idea of what is it that produces Christian kids, and what is your role in that? I also realize that I'm talking to some of you who are past that stage of active child rearing, and you maybe have kids who share your faith, and maybe you have kids that don't. And I recognize that particularly for some of you who may not have kids that are walking in the ways that you would hope that they would, that there can be for you some guilt. There can be some shame in that, a feeling of, you know, what have I done wrong? That they don't carry on the faith that I tried to pass to them. And then others of you, maybe you're not parents at all, so you can't relate to this, but I suspect that even if you can't relate directly to this subject, you know someone that can. And I hope you come away from this with some, maybe some words of encouragement or comfort to offer them. So let's dive into this subject. And at the root of the myth is one particular verse in the book of Proverbs. And I suspect that many of you will know that verse or will have heard that verse somewhere along the line. The verse, it's on the screen, you see it. Start children off on the way they should go. Or some of you will know it maybe in different language. Train up a child in the way he should go. And even when they are old, they will not turn from it, or they will not depart from it. Now, that sounds clear and emphatic, doesn't it? It doesn't sound like there's a whole lot of wiggle room there. But we've got to understand what this is. This is from the book of Proverbs. And so we want to burst the bubble a little bit by acknowledging that these words from Proverbs 22:6, great words, are a proverb. They are not a promise. And there's an important difference between proverbs and promises. So a proverb is kind of a pithy little statement about the way life usually goes. It's the way things usually are. So the book of Proverbs in our Bibles is a collection of God-inspired observations about the way life usually works. But a proverb is not universal. A proverb is not a promise. A promise is something you can take to the bank. A promise is something that will be true no matter what. A proverb is usually true. But to most proverbs, and there's 31 chapters of Proverbs in your Bibles, and I'm not going to have you turn in your scriptures this morning. We're going to be bouncing all around. But the book of Proverbs, you could read the Proverbs, and for many of them, perhaps most of the Proverbs that you find in the book of Proverbs, you could find an exception. So sometimes good people aren't always honored. Sometimes the wicked do succeed. Sometimes hardworking people lose it all, and sometimes the lazy strike it rich. Because proverbs are not promises. The nature of a proverb is such that it will usually and often happen this particular way, but not always. Often, this is the way of things, but not always. So back to Proverbs 22:6. Start children off on the way they should go. And some scholars will look at that and they'll say, okay, so it's saying start kids off on the way. And the emphasis is on the way. So you train kids on the way to be godly. And then they will ultimately stick with that in their lives. Now, an interesting phenomenon comes about is when people really focus on the idea of the way from that proverb. So, you know, you can find books and you can find all kind of curriculum materials about raising kids God's way. And many of those books and curriculum materials will have very positive aspects to it, but sometimes I wonder if they don't, again, cross from proverb into promise and suggest that, you know, if you follow this formula, if you lay down these rules with your kids, then this is how they will turn out. You know, kind of like a factory production line. You know, you pop your kid into this particular way of doing things, and out will pop a mature Christian adult at the end. Now, other scholars will, instead of focusing on, you know, start them off on the way, will focus on start them off on the way they should go. And the idea is you take into account their unique personalities and their gifts. You know, you take into account who they are. And then you help them become the most godly versions of themselves that is possible. And I like that interpretation a little better. But I'd still come back to the idea that there is no guarantee. Gary Thomas is an author who wrote what is my favorite book on parenting. He wrote a book called Sacred Parenting. And he says that what leads to this kind of perspective, that a godly home guarantees godly children, is linear thinking that many of us, you know, can become a party to. Linear thinking, the idea, if I do good, then God will bless me. In fact, he must bless me, and all my children will become godly believers. But if I mess up, you know, then again, you're drawing lines. It's linear thinking. If I mess up, then God will curse me. He will punish me financially, relationally, vocationally, and my children will inevitably destroy their lives. That's kind of the way linear thinking goes. And Thomas points out, you know, that really diminishes the nature of being human. I mean, we are not robots. What we're doing when we're parenting is we are shepherding the hearts of the image bearers of the Creator, who live with freedom to choose, who have their own wills, and who have personal responsibility for the choices that they make. And so I would summarize what Proverbs 22:6 is saying this way. Children with godly parents will often become godly themselves. This is often what happens. When you start kids off on this way, on the way toward being godly, and you take into account their unique personalities and gifts, and when you start them off on that way, often they will follow. And they will become godly adults, and throughout their whole lives, they will live out that faith of their parents. But it's always their choice. And here's the reality. As we're raising kids, at some point, children must own the faith for themselves. Or not. I mean, the faith of parents can only go so far. At some point, kids have to decide what they will do with the faith that they have been taught. And the reality is that many do decide to follow suit. There is correlation there. But there is not causation. It's not a pure cause and effect relationship. Children have to decide for themselves what they will do with the faith, whether they will embrace it and follow it for themselves or not. Now let's dig a little deeper on this idea of cause and effect parenting. There's a problem. There's probably a number of problems with cause and effect parenting. And one of them is this. That is, it can make us, the parents, feel too proud or too guilty. Let's unpack that a little bit. Some parents, and you know the parents, you've seen them. Some parents have kids who are naturally obedient and compliant, you know, model citizen kinds of kids. And there can be a temptation for the parents of those kinds of children to, you know, feel a little bit of pride, you know, look at what I did. Because I was so loving and so involved and so godly and so, you know, fill in the blank, so humble, you know, my kids turned out this way. can be a lot of pride. There's also another side. What about the parents who have a hyperactive child? What about the parents who have a child who's learning disabled? Or a rebellious child? Or, you know, a child who's emotionally struggling? Or a strong-willed child? What about those parents? Now, they can tend to feel a lot of guilt. You know, what did we do wrong? And we have a tendency that often reinforces that perspective. And I suspect that we've all, you know, fallen prey to this tendency at times. You know, you're out in public and you see a family with, you know, these well-behaved children that just stand, you know, right there beside their parents the whole time. And then you see others. And what do you tend to do? We tend to make judgments about not the children, but about the parents, based on what the kids are doing, whether they're the meek, compliant ones, or, you know, the out of control everywhere, you know, and the parents are chasing them around the whole time. I mean, we make judgments about the parents based on the kids' behavior. But, you know, we are seeing such a tiny slice of the picture. I mean, we don't know what the reality with those kids are like. We don't know what the reality for those parents are like. I mean, what we know about the parents is that at best, they are fallible, broken human beings. And often they are not at their best. Often we are not at our best. You know, Gary Thomas goes on and he talks about the problem with many how-to parenting books. He says, you know, many of these how-to parenting books assume that you have time and energy to write out the reward charts and draw up the discipline contracts, and then that you have the peace of mind the calmness to be able to administer them well. And they also assume that you and your spouse are on exactly the same page on all of these things, and that you don't feel buried by financial pressure, and that you never have headaches or cramps or pressing deadlines at work. Parenting is complicated business for the best of us. And that's before you even talk about the children. I mean, then you introduce the complex personalities and issues that kids have. Thomas goes on and he tells a story about one mother who felt terrible because she missed the early warning signs of mental illness in her oldest child. And as she looked back on that experience, the conclusion that she came to is a big part of the reason that she missed it is because her second child was a virtual tornado. I mean, this kid was all over the place. She spent so much time and energy trying to keep this boy from burning down the house or jumping off a cliff that she missed the small, subtle signals that there was something seriously amiss with her quiet, compliant daughter. And Thomas says, anybody with such a child can understand how something like this can happen. Parenting is a complex game, infinitely more difficult than chess. It's so complex. I mean, Pastor Larry Osborne, he said that before he and his wife had kids, if he would have preached a sermon on raising children, the sermon would have been titled something like 10 Rules for Raising Godly Kids. But with each additional child that they had, the titles would have changed. So, you know, with no kids, it would have been 10 Rules for Raising Godly Kids. And then add a child, and it would be 10 Guidelines for Raising Good Kids. And then another child, and it would be 5 Principles for Raising Kids. And then finally, 3 suggestions for surviving parenthood. I mean, you know, kids are complicated. And then, you know, throw in this other interesting reality that some of the traits in kids that we appreciate in them as adults, we didn't appreciate so much when they were kids and vice versa. I mean, Osborne goes on and he says this, the stubbornness of a 3-year-old is called backbone and conviction in a 33-year-old. The highly acclaimed, out-of-the-box thinking entrepreneur was most likely once a kindergartner in trouble for refusing to color in the lines. Class clowns sometimes become perpetual goof-offs, but they can also become the life of the party or the leader that everyone lines up to follow. As for the can't-sit-still-for-30-seconds 7-year-old, he fits the early profile of the high-powered multitasking executive who just hired our compliant kid to be his office manager. And amidst that complexity of parents and kids and the interplay between, sometimes we would be tempted to take a whole lot of credit for the good things that our kids do. And sometimes we would be tempted to take a whole lot of blame and feel a whole lot of guilt when our kids don't do the things that we wish they would. And if those examples don't speak to you, consider two family lines in the scriptures. And I'm not going to take you there, but some of you will recognize the names. Back in the Old Testament of the scriptures, there's a character named Samuel. Samuel was dedicated to God by his parents when he was just a young boy. Now, some of you will remember from Sunday school, I mean, Samuel as a boy hears God speaking to him audibly. And Samuel would go on as an adult to become a prophet and judge of ancient Israel. You know, when he died, the whole nation mourned his death. But something interesting happens in 1 Samuel chapter 8. In that chapter, which was during the time of his leadership in Israel, you know, some of the elders of the people come to him and they say, "We need a king." Up until that time, I mean, God had always been the king of his people, and so they didn't need an earthly king because they had God, the perfect king. Well, some of the elders come and they say, "We need to be like the nations around us. We need like a real flesh and blood king." And Samuel, you know, he goes back to them and he says, you know, a king could become a tyrant. I mean, it could go very badly for you having a king. And they say, "No, we need a king." And you know what part of the reason that they give for wanting a king is? Samuel's two sons. Samuel's two sons who are dishonest, who are greedy, and who are unjust. And they say, "We don't want them being our prophets and judges next. We need a king." You have a great man of God with kids who were not. And interestingly, the writer never gives us any kind of assessment for how the sons ended up that way when they had such a great dad. So that's a mystery to us. But you have a great man and kids who are not. Fast forward a few hundred years to a king of Judah named Ahaz. Ahaz was one of the worst kings that Judah ever had. I mean, 1 Kings 16 tells us that Ahaz actually had one of his own children sacrificed in the fire to false gods. Terrible king. And Ahaz had a son named Hezekiah. And 1 Kings 18:5 tells us this. It says, Hezekiah trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel. There was no one like him among all the kings of Judah, either before him or after him. He held fast to the Lord and did not stop following him. He kept the commands the Lord had given Moses. Terrible parent. An incredibly godly son. Yes, we need to be careful not to take too much credit when our kids do the things that we would like them to do, and not to take too much blame when they don't. So what do we do? Well, parents, let's do our imperfect best with what we have. That is our task as parents. We do our imperfect best with what we have. The scriptures are clear that the role of parents is essential. Having said everything I just said, the role of parents is so important. I mean, Moses says to the Israelites in Deuteronomy, impress God's commands on your children. Paul writes to Christians, do not embitter your children or they will become discouraged. Bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. Crucial role of parents. And yet, as we've already discussed, parents have limitations. I mean, we all have very finite knowledge. I mean, some of us, some of us come into the task of parenting hampered significantly by the life experiences we've had prior. You know, some of us had poor role models as parents. And even those of us that had the best role models as parents still had fallible parents who made mistakes, and we come into the task of parenthood ourselves saying, I'm not going to do it like that. But you know, it seems that God takes into account. He takes into account who we are and where we come from and the limitations we have. Jesus once said this. In Luke 12, he said, from everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. And from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. Now, the context of that verse is not parenting. You know, the context of what Jesus is saying there is about how his followers ought to live in light of his second coming. But I read that verse in a new way this week. When you think about it as parents, I mean, for any of us in our way of following Jesus, including our parenthood. Isn't this an interesting verse? That God seems to look at what we have. And we don't all receive the same amount of wisdom, amount of knowledge. We don't all have the same experiences growing up. Some are blessed immensely and come into the role of parenting with immense advantages, and God looks at them in light of those advantages. And some people come to the task of parenting with major limitations. And God is not comparing those parents to the other ones. He's looking at each of us and asking us, what are we doing with what we have? What are you doing with what you have? As a parent, what are you doing with what you have? Not what someone else has, not with what anyone else has. What kind of parent are you with what you have? Do your best and know that it will be imperfect. And then realize this, that children are responsible for their choices. Now, the Israelites weren't convinced of this. And so the prophet Ezekiel tried to clarify it for them when he said these words. He said, the one who sins is the one who will die. The child will not share the guilt of the parent, nor will the parent share the guilt of the child. The righteousness of the righteous will be credited to them, and the wickedness of the wicked will be charged against them. Individual sins don't get handed out from parent to child. But one thing that all parents do give their children is a sin nature. It's the gift that keeps on giving. You know, it's a tendency, a bent toward selfishness and self-destructiveness, and there's a seed of it in each one of us, and we pass that seed on to our children. And we all live out of that nature, and we are all accountable for the choices that we make. The theological language for that is we are free moral agents. Now, we have freedom, and we make choices, and some of those choices are moral, and some of them are not. But no one will be able to stand before God one day and say about their choices, well, my mom made me do it, or my dad made me do it, or my spouse made me do it, or the devil made me do it. Our choices are our choices, and our children's choices are theirs. Consider for a moment in Genesis 3, Adam and Eve living in paradise in the Garden of Eden, you know, as close to perfection as this world has seen. No sin nature within them. And who were their parents? Well, the Trinity, you know, God, the three in one. Perfect parenting. And how did that end? You know? The effects of the kids, Adam and Eve's choices, continue to ripple out into the world. They had no parents but God, and they still rebelled. And so, surely we shouldn't be surprised when our children rebel. But there's good news, great news. There is mercy and there is forgiveness for self-willed children who become imperfect parents, and imperfect parents who were once self-willed children. There is mercy, there is grace, there is forgiveness. I want to end this morning with another proverb. We started with a proverb, I want to end there. It's kind of an interesting one, Proverbs 21:31. The horse is made ready for the day of battle, but victory rests with the Lord. What on earth does that have to do with parenting? Feels like a battle sometimes, doesn't it? Soldiers going into battle realize that there are a lot of things that they can't control. I mean, they really can't control what the outcome is going to be. But what they can do is they can get their horse ready for the battle. There are plenty of situations in life, parents. Have you noticed this? That are out of our control. We can't control the outcome. Godly parents cannot make sure that their kids are godly. What they can do is they can prepare their kids to fight the good fight and to keep the faith if they will. They can plant seeds of godliness, and as we plant those seeds, none of us knows how it will end. But victory rests with the Lord, who can do something with our failures that is unbelievable. He can take our failures as parents and the failures of our children, and somehow he can weave something unbelievable out of them that shapes we the parents and that shapes our children. Victory rests with him. I'm going to give Larry Osborne the last word. He wrote, parenting is a tough job, advice is easy, so is critique. But for those of us in the midst of the battle, it's not so simple. It's not cause and effect. Rather than preening in pride, casting harsh judgments, or wallowing in self-pity and unwarranted guilt, we simply need to cast aside the myth that produces these unsavory responses and live in light of the truth. As parents, we do have a sacred responsibility for how we raise our kids, but we have no ultimate control over how they turn out. If you're a parent, give it your best shot. Then go take a nap. If you've already given it your best shot, take a long nap. You deserve it. Pray with me if you would. For those of us, God, tempted to be proud or tempted to cast judgment on others, for those of us who feel a lot of guilt and self-pity, we bring those responses to you. And we ask for your mercy and your grace and your forgiveness. And we ask for your help, that you would help us in the midst of the battles of life to do what we can. And then to leave the rest to you. You are our help. You are the one we need. Ultimately, victory rests with you. And so, would you meet us in this place as we look to you? In Jesus' name, amen.